Imagine if you lived in a world where you were constantly watched. A world where everything is controlled by the elite, where you're bombarded with non-stop propaganda. A world where everyone is repressed, lonely, and isolated, existing as one insignificant cog in an incomprehensible machine. This is the chilling vision of the future that George Orwell put forward in his masterpiece 1984. And does this sound familiar? It's no coincidence that his predictions have come true in nearly every single way in our modern society today. So let's take a deep dive into the story of 1984 to learn how you're being controlled and if you can ever break free. Now, the movie begins with a quote from the iconic book that it was adapted from. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. And this sets the stage. And then without delay, we are then shown the iconic shot of a crowd of people staring at propaganda presented by the party. The party is the shadowy government which controls every aspect of life through their ideology INSOC. The basic principle is to control information so tightly that every aspect of life is dictated and controlled by the party. Absolute obedience is expected, down to rejecting basic facts about life and even your own thoughts and memories. On the screen, a video player is creating an idyllic image of the country that the West has become, all under this totalitarian rule, Oceania. This is one of the three superstates which make up the world of 1984, with control over the Americas, Britain, Australia, and some parts of Africa. And this is when we're introduced to the concept of Big Brother, and a man named Goldstein, who attempts to persuade the people of Oceania that they are being duped. But despite the truth in what he's saying, he's drowned out by shouts from the audience. INSOC has conditioned them to reject the truth entirely, to the point they don't even want to hear it. Throughout the demonstration, you can see the INSOC salutes, something that was borrowed from historical totalitarian regimes. And after this propaganda video reaches its climax, the crowd is pacified by the symbol of INSOC alongside the face of Big Brother. It's afterwards that we're introduced to our main character, Winston Smith, who is working in an office cubicle for the Ministry of Truth. His job is to edit past broadcasts to reflect the current reality that they're pushing. So if the sugar ration has been reduced from last year, he will then edit last year's paper to imply that it actually went up instead. And then once he's finished with his day's work, Winston makes his way back home, where propaganda is already being played in his house. This time, it's a man being shamed for falling under Goldstein's influence. The man has been charged for attempting to persuade the public that they're not at a war with Eurasia, but rather East Asia. This information control on Eurasia is central to Big Brother's control of the people, as over time, the party has rewritten reality to suit their needs. Now, Winston is a key part of this process, but obviously this brings up contradictions, and that's where the concept of doublethink comes in. The idea of wholeheartedly believing in two separate contradictory facts. One of the examples they give in the novel is the simultaneous belief that the party is a bastion of democracy, and also that democracy is impossible. And it's through this concept that the party rewrites reality, replacing it with an illusion of their own creation. And this is the all-encompassing lie that maintains 1984 society. It's only through everyone believing it that it becomes real. But this concept of a world founded on fiction isn't something that Orwell created all by himself. Instead, this is something that's very real and has been observed throughout history. Thousands of years ago, Plato wrote some of the first recorded philosophy on this concept, through what he called the noble lie, where people know their place in society through their belief in an entirely fictional story about the society's origin. The details aren't important, so long as it gives justification for the social order. And this gives people a reason to accept how the world is, and that their equal man is somehow better or worse than him. And we see this today, when our own version of Big Brother says one thing and then means another. Like when the establishment media, politicians, and World Economic Forum claim to be working for freedom and free speech, also while doing everything they can to bully and censor all criticism into silence. And there are just countless examples of this, like when the fattest, most grotesque politicians of them all claim that they're promoting health. And this concept has evolved over time as people realize that all of society's institutions are built upon a necessary fiction. And this is known as the habitus. It's the thou you need to see through for society to make sense. Now, the concept is similar to the noble lie, but the habitus goes much deeper. You see, throughout your life, you are influenced by your environment and your interactions with other people. And these combined with your personality create your view of the world. And it's in this way that you buy into the habitus, the shared societal illusion of how the world should be. You were socialized into the habitus. It's come down from above, and everyone else around you believes in it. The habitus is the social contract between you, your fellow man, and the government. And it's what determines your culture. It's what determines all the societal trends around you, and therefore also decides the rules of society. And this stretches to everything. Our ideas of beauty, what's seen as valuable, what's seen as even right and wrong. But because it's influenced by the environment and how people treat each other, the habitus is always changing to reflect this. And the world of 1984 operates on a habitus. The problem with the 1984 Habitus is that it's been cracked at the top and severely deformed, and because it's been poisoned at the top, it's trickled down into all elements of society. And this is why 1984 is so scary. In fact, 1984 is far more unsettling than any dumb horror film because it's so realistic. We all instinctively know what the future could be like because we're so close to it today. Our society that we live in right now is just a few steps away from totalitarianism, and Orwell was trying to warn us of all of this. Because throughout the story, we're going to see exactly how the party has warped the habitus and society, and how it's affected everyone within the society. So getting straight back into the story, and we see Winston sitting alone in his decrepit apartment, and it's here after lighting a cigarette that Winston introduces us to the concept of thought crime. Now, thought crime is the act of going against the habitus of the world, even in your deepest thoughts. Just considering rebellion is already rebellion, because it's something outside of the party's reality. The party enforces this through the Thought Police, a secret organization which uses informants, surveillance, and undercover agents to root out anyone who even thinks about rebelling. And as the propaganda continues playing in the background on the ever-present screen, Winston lifts a brick from his house and uncovers his journal, something that's definitely banned in the world he lives in. And it's in this journal that Winston reminisces about a world where thought was free, a time where minds weren't controlled by Big Brother and the Thought Police. And by doing this, he's already become a thought criminal just through his own memories. And upon waking up the next day, Winston is then subjected to a mandatory exercise routine in front of his television, to which he is signaled out for not performing adequately. Winston then half-heartedly waves the in-sock hand signal and makes his way to work. And that's when he's treated even more propaganda playing on the television during lunch hour. However, what instead catches the eye of Winston is a young woman staring at him. Winston then sits down and begins eating his meal, when one of his colleagues comments on the new shortened dictionary and how positive the destructions of word really is. Newspeak, as they call it, is a new language invented by the party that reduces English to its bare essentials, where controversial words are removed, meaning that if it works, then rebellion will be impossible, because it won't even be able to be considered. The words just won't exist for it. Back at work, Winston then continues his job at the Ministry of Truth, this time unpersoning someone. Now, unpersoning is the act of essentially removing someone from history and replacing them with someone else. And this is just one of the many aspects of 1984, which has its roots in previous autocracies. Now, in this, Orwell was specifically alluding to Stalin's dictatorship, where this was an extremely common practice. Enemies of the state, or rather enemies of Stalin, wouldn't just be executed. Every mention of their name and even their image and photographs was erased, completely removing them from history. However, this practice, of course, hasn't died out. The Chinese government, for example, was infamous for disappearing anyone they don't like. Jack Ma, the CEO of Alibaba, essentially disappeared from public view after making economic suggestions that would shift power away from the Chinese Communist Party. And today, he's all but vanished from the public eye, spending his time in exile under constant surveillance. But we're not just talking about China. This is happening all over the West. When anyone who speaks out against the agenda set in place by Western governments, they are then often censored or bullied into silence. Whether it be Julian Assange or Edward Snowden talking about the government's crimes, or any other supposed thought criminal who's been cancelled on social media for talking about COVID and its origins. Anything deemed a thought crime and you can be cancelled immediately. I mean, it's gotten to the point now where FBI and other government intelligence agencies are infiltrating and working in conjunction with all the big social media sites. And once they have control of sites like Twitter, they can then censor any narrative they don't like, shadow banning or completely deleting people from the sites. But it's not just social media companies. Now even companies like Uber, PayPal, and even Airbnb can ban you for having the wrong opinions online. And then over in China is their infamous social credit system. The basic idea is for each person to be assigned a personal score based on how trustworthy they are according to the Chinese government. Certain things can increase your score, like making a social media post praising the government. But on the other hand, things like getting into debt, buying too many video games, reading the Bible, or criticizing the government deducts points from your score. And if your score falls too low, the CCP will then severely reduce your already restricted freedoms, as people with a low score can have trouble buying train or even plane tickets. Some people have even had their pets taken away from them, with one student even being denied a place at university because his father had a low score. For now, the system has only been put into practice by some scattered regional governments, but it won't be that way for very long. And recently, Xi Jinping pushed through new laws to lay the groundwork, meaning that a nationwide social credit system is just a few years away. I mean, recently it's gotten so bad in China that a new law just passed, which means that farmers can only plant the crops the government approves of. And the personal planting of vegetables like beans, melons, squashes in your front or backyard is now strictly forbidden. And in the West, we're also seeing a gradual progression of repression, which is exactly what George Orwell feared. So after he finishes with his work for the day, Winston makes his way to an antique store in the slum districts of London and meets the owner who sold him his journal. He buys a coral figurine, taped with glass, and makes his way out of the store, where he meets the same woman who was staring at him during lunch. The woman continues looking at him ominously, going into the proletariat zones in London, something that is forbidden by the party. She could sell him out, and so Winston considers killing her back at his apartment. Coincidentally enough though, the two see each other the very next day in an underpass. The woman stumbles and falls to the ground, but quickly makes her way back on her feet. Secretly, as he's helping her, the woman hands Winston a note before leaving. At work, Winston unveils the note, and it reads, "I love you," along with a meetup location on the backside. Seemingly without a second thought, Winston tosses the note into the incinerator, and we transition back to his apartment, where Winston is fixing his neighbor's drain at the behest of his neighbor's wife. At the apartment, one of the neighbor's children loudly accuses him of being a thought criminal. Obviously, this makes Winston very nervous. It's an accusation which can lead to death and suffering, and it's coincidentally true. But both of the adults ignore it. It's just the result of youth indoctrination. However, it's true all the same. Luckily, before the confrontation can go any further though, a news flash interrupts the engagement. The announcement states that the war with Eurasia is reaching an end. But with how the flow of information works in a totalitarian state, who can really say if this is the case? And it's afterwards we see a mob of citizens cheering on executions playing from the television, along with a bunch of Eurasian prisoners being escorted to their impending death. Winston is among this crowd, along with a mysterious woman who hands Winston another note. She is relying on him to destroy it. Winston abides and says that he will finally meet her at the drop point, taking a train to the destination. On the train ride, a band of children are then singing a propaganda song, where they pledge loyal devotion to the state and to die with dignity. And it's in these two scenes where we see a worrying aspect of the world in 1984. The party only came to power just a few decades ago, but the new generation of completely indoctrinated children is already approaching adulthood. In the novel, Winston notes that the children are the most dogmatic and fanatic supporters of Big Brother. Growing up in the system means their habitus is completely under the control of government. One day, the last people who can remember the old war like Winston will die, leaving no one left who knows anything outside of the state's control. A truly terrifying thought. And so once Winston exits on a stop, we see our first glimpse of nature in the movie. This change of scenery is a stark contrast to the industrial environment that the majority of Oceania resides in. Winston is now out in the forest and looking for the drop point, until he hears a twig snap behind him. It's the woman, and she has been following him the whole time. When the two get to a scheduled hiding place, it's here where we get an insight into Winston's worldview. After learning that the woman has done this exact stunt with hundreds of men, Winston states that he hates goodness and doesn't want virtue to exist anywhere.
I hate purity. I hate goodness. I don't want virtue to exist anywhere. I want everyone corrupt.
Well, I ought to suit you then.
Winston wants everyone corrupted, much to the delight of the women. This state of mind is a direct response to the tyranny of Winston's society, meaning that everything the party and the habitus sees as good is turned on its head. And because of this overwhelming level of control in the society, all Winston really wants to do is yell bullshit at all the lies slung at him. But most of the things that Winston thinks are bad or corrupted just aren't. They're normal parts of life which the party sees as a threat to their authority, and therefore it's outlawed. It's part of the tactic of keeping the people impoverished and uneducated, as this makes them far easier to control. Because real education and economic prosperity are the two worst things for Big Brother. As they're not trying to enlighten you or save your soul, it's all about control. The more you commit to their ideology, the more they can poison your soul. And that's why in the book Orwell writes, every record has been destroyed or failed, every book rewritten, every picture repainted, every statue and street building has been renamed, every date has been altered. It's a beautiful thing, the destruction of words. And today in our own world, we're seeing a very similar process unfold. You see, things as simple as children's books, I'm talking Roald Dahl books, are now being pushed through a demented purity filter, where all bad words or paragraphs are now being rewritten. Words like witches have been turned to hags, fat turned to ginormous, black person to dark, cloud men to cloud people. Entire sections of these children books are being rewritten to eliminate any wrongthink. And this isn't just children's books. This is happening throughout all genres. Roald Dahl is just the most egregious example of this. But it doesn't even stop there, because even a recent UK government-backed report has now claimed that reading George Orwell's 1984 is a sign of, quote, extremism. So Western governments are now characterizing people who read 1984 as potential enemies of the state. And this isn't just happening with words, we're also seeing this in the same form of economic control. As we're all familiar with, the past few decades have seen enormous inequality that has steadily risen over the last 40 years. Which is why by 2019, the world's richest 26 people owned more wealth than the poorest 50%. But then after COVID, the biggest wealth transfer in history occurred. Now to put into scale how big this wealth transfer truly was, we have to look at the stats. In early 2020, before COVID began, billionaires alone as just people owned 2% of total global wealth. And this is only including publicly available information. But just a year later, and this number was now 3.5%. 1.5% more of the total global wealth has gone to just billionaires alone, all in a single year. And the result of this is ginormous wealth for the top elites and a never-ending hamster wheel for the masses, where you can never control your own money, where you never own anything, where you have no property, land, or assets, or even any prospect of owning these things in the future, just continually renting everything with nothing to your name. Because in the last couple of years, as wages have stagnated, the cost of everything around you has gone up exponentially, only continuing to go up and up while your income starts to shrink. And so it was no surprise that as this great wealth transfer unfolded, the World Economic Forum unveiled their new plan, the Great Reset. Now, for those of you unaware, the World Economic Forum is a priestly caste of people, mixed up of global leaders, royal families, BlackRock, the world's biggest companies, the biggest banks, the biggest pharmaceutical companies, mainstream media outlets, and the top celebrities. Pretty much a culmination of the world's most powerful people. And these are the people who create agendas and policies that are then adopted by organizations such as the UN, World Bank, IMF, and national governments. And this private organization has no democratic vote, and yet it is quite clearly one of the most powerful organizations the world has ever seen. Not just affecting the West, but also Russia and China. So when they unveiled their plan for a Great Reset, this marked a new chapter in human history, and the leader of this organization is Klaus Schwab, who claimed the Great Reset would provide a unique window of opportunity to reshape our world.
And I see the need for action, I see the need for a Great Reset.
And one part of this agenda was to make the world greener and more carbon neutral, which sounds great, but what exactly did he mean by this? Well, as you might have noticed, all governments in the West in just the last year have promoted these policies heavily, with the West now being forced to cut their ammonium and nitrogen emissions by 50% alone. However, for many farmers in Europe, their livestock normally produce ammonia and urine and feces, and so farmers all across Europe were recently forced to cut 30% of their livestock, which meant huge swaths of farmers were forced out of business by the government. And yet these same rules never applied for sectors like the airline industry. So suddenly, farmers and workers across Europe protested. But at first, these protests were smeared as just crazy right-wingers. But as this resentment grew and the protests gripped European nations, the government acted harshly, with live rounds being fired upon these protesters. I mean, in the Netherlands, they even changed the law that officers who killed protesters were now immune from manslaughter charges. And whilst the media covered this up, the Dutch government would never receive any backlash, as they were cowering to the World Economic Forum orders. And the working class people in Europe were forced to see their futures destroyed before them, as they were attacked and mocked in the media. And so it was no surprise that around this period, Klaus Schwab, the leader of the World Economic Forum, warned of increasing anger.
We have to prepare for a more angry world.
Because Western governments were now forcing the food supply to run dry, whilst artificially inflating the prices amidst a global food shortage, only deepening the economic crisis that the majority of the West were facing. And in an act of doublethink, something that came straight out of 1984, media outlets like Reuters would then claim that there was no evidence that the Dutch government worked with the World Economic Forum to impose these new laws, which really isn't all that surprising given the World Economic Forum partnered with Reuters for exclusive content distribution, as the World Economic Forum, otherwise known as Big Brother, controls the flow of information. And while she might not see the anger in the news, these protests haven't stopped in Europe. I mean, just recently, protests have gripped the country of France, as the President Macron has risen the pension age, meaning it's going to take longer and longer before workers can ever receive a pension. Even though the majority of France hates this idea, this was imposed anyway, as democracy in Western nations is becoming a facade. In fact, democracies aren't even obeying the people anymore. They obey corporate and financial interests rather than the popular vote, the World Economic Forum over the people. And that's why our freedoms are slowly being stripped economically and socially. Because if everyone had social and economic freedom, then the whole system would collapse. And instead of new parties emerging and addressing these protests, you're now seeing the militarization of the police, more surveillance, more distraction. And it's following this agenda that people like Bill Gates are claiming at the World Economic Forum that during our current worst cost of living crisis and the ongoing fuel shortages, Bill thinks that workers should now also be paying carbon taxes, all whilst people like Bill Gates are using the most carbon of all. They'll preach things like private property for the average person will be a bygone relic, all while snapping up record amounts of farmland across the US, following their mantra of you'll own nothing and be happy. And all you're left with is again more distraction, more noise, more misery, more tension and more depression. No more family units, less farms, less freedoms and no more rights to pursue happiness. And this is just one of the reasons our habitus has been violently shifted towards consumerism and hollow material wealth, because we're being starved of it, and it's the perfect means to keep control in society. But how did things ever get this bad? This has never really happened in living memory. Well, what Orwell didn't foresee was that pleasure was just as useful a tool to keep the masses numbed. You see, as they slowly siphon the wealth out of the economy, The elites keep us distracted with hollow, empty hedonism, and modern technology is the perfect tools for this. By exploiting the basic social need to be accepted, social media applications exploit your dopamine receptors in the exact same way as cocaine. Years of split testing are perfecting the algorithms, and billions of dollars in research have made big tech companies like Facebook and TikTok as addictive as possible. And as people build up a tolerance, they always need more content faster to stay engaged, all while procrastinating and wasting their life away, being numbed into flaccid apathy in their bedrooms. The rise of TikTok, YouTube Shorts, and all these other short-form social media sites is just a direct result of this process. It's why we're developing parasocial relationships with streamers and not our own communities. Giving the people the illusion of community and knowing what's going on in the world, all without any real substance or true information, and by providing a drip-drip of anodyne lethargic dross. The meaning in your life is sucked away. The resentment you feel at the government is numbed and repressed inside of you, and so you accept it. And anytime you feel depressed, isolated, like things are just outside of your control, there's always that little dopamine fix just sitting in your pocket, pushing people more and more into the online realms, stuck alone in your bedroom. And the result of this is what you see today, the most depressed and downtrodden generation in living memory. As the normal societal habitus is breaking down, it's taking away your motivation to go out in the world and make something of yourself. You don't have the energy to call out bullshit against your government and the people preaching their agenda. Responsibility, duty, purpose, these key pillars that have motivated men for millennia have all been pushed out of the societal framework. Instead, consumerism and greed are the only things to look up to now. But the worst aspect of this is the effect it's had on people's relationships with each other. I mean, our current habitus right now is leaving 63% of men under age 30 single and alone, and a large majority of them aren't dating at all. Millions of men are experiencing the exact same lovelessness that Winston's known his entire life up until now. But before we continue, I want to tell you about something I've been working on this past month. You see, I've built something that I legitimately think will change your life. Because you see, for most of your life, you've always been fed a constant stream of lies. Lies that have poisoned your value systems, purpose, and passion in life, whilst also poisoning the community around you. And it's why you feel so lazy, so meaningless, so lonely. And so it's time that we've come up with real solutions. Not just modern day BS solutions. I'm talking about a new form of community. A way for us to take back control of our lives. Where I will go deep into the real solutions, answers, and value systems of thousands of philosophers condensed into an easy to understand package, all to help you improve your life. All at no cost to you, I will send you a weekly essay on the solutions to the problems we discuss on this channel. So just click on the link in the description and add your email and name down below. After Winston and the woman get to know each other a little better, we then transition back to the antique store, where Winston plans on renting out the place. And once they're sure they're finally somewhere private, the duo secretly engage in an unsanctioned relationship against the state. We also finally get the name of the woman, being revealed as Julia. In this moment, both of them can finally relax and enjoy themselves, even if just for a little while. They then enjoy some contraband items that Julia smuggles from the party, like real chocolate and coffee. And for a while, their little conspiracy works quite well for them. Up until this point, Winston has been completely in the dark on whether there's an active resistance movement. But in his mind, he's certain that he has some level of understanding with an inner party member, a man called O'Brien. So when O'Brien corners Winston in a hallway, he's full of hope for a way to resist. O'Brien tells Winston that he's a fan of his writing, but he does mention that there were a few unwords in his latest piece, and recommends he reads the state's next dictionary edition. When he goes to collect it from O'Brien's office, Winston is outstanded by the luxuries that he enjoys. He offers him real wine, something that Winston has never tasted before, and O'Brien can even turn off his telescreen. But the most precious thing O'Brien offers Winston is hope, when he tells him about the resistance against the party. And it's here that we get an introduction to the shadowy practices of how INSOC truly operates. Between the pages of dictionary that O'Brien gave him, Winston finds a different book titled The Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism, which is basically a manual on how INSOC and Big Brother operate, and the author is listed as Emmanuel Goldstein. Now, it goes over a lot of what we've already covered, but it also tells Winston about what's really going on in the world's politics. You see, in the world of 1984, three superstates have reached global dominance. There's Oceania, which controls the Americas, South Africa, and the UK. Then there's Eurasia, a Soviet successor state, which rules over Russia, parts of Asia, and Europe. And then finally there's East Asia, a successor of China, which controls the Far East. The three states exist in a constant cycle of war, endlessly shifting alliances and fighting for control over the rest of the world. But they're not trying to win. They all have enough resources for their impoverished people. The states are also pretty much the same in their beliefs. Eurasia's neo-Bolshevikism and East Asia's obliteration of the self are almost identical to INSOC, meaning there aren't really any ideological differences. Instead, this war only exists to suck up resources and keep people in poverty. It keeps their societies and their brutal ideologies running, all in order to maintain control. George Orwell envisioned a dead end, to put it simply, a world where progress and forward movement have been stifled by three world powers to guarantee their control of the people. And so as Winston sits at home, we learn that Oceania has once again shifted alliances, and now the war is with East Asia, and Eurasia is now their ally. Which is just another bit of doublethink, and it doesn't really change anything for Oceania's people. It's just more propaganda and more control for the populace. And that's why the parallels of our real-life politics and that of 1984 is truly uncanny. Where secret families and powerful shadowy organizations like the World Economic Forum fuel both sides of wars. Where world enemies are friends behind closed doors. Where governments continually change our enemies and ally with people that we're told to hate. But then this really does beg the question, where do these big powerful governments and these shadowy organizations actually come from? Why does Big Brother exist? And why do we decide as humans to follow the order of these totalitarian regimes and governments? Well, the answer simply lies in understanding how governments form in the first place. Now, Thomas Hobbes was one of the first political theorists to understand this, in his widely renowned book, Leviathan. Now, he wrote this after his experiences during the English Civil War, a brutal conflict where the country for over a decade was split into two by the parliamentarians and the royalists. During this period, beheadings were common, and the violence was barbaric, and it was this chaos that inspired his thoughts on governance. In this book, he first talks about human nature and primitive life, back in the time when humans were cavemen, living a tribal existence. And he famously described this life as nasty, brutish, and short. The lack of laws and complete chaos of nature led to a constant fear of death in the people. There was no actual progress, because people were either too afraid of each other, or just too busy in their fight for survival. There was hardly any social cohesion, there was no rule of law, and there was no societal development. And it was this primitive fear for survival that laid the groundwork for society. So to avoid this constant struggle for survival, men willingly lay down their claims to the world to live in a peaceful collective under one powerful ruler. And for Thomas Hobbes, this was the optimal form of government, where one powerful state with a sole ruler did his best to protect the people. That way, everything follows one trajectory of the leader. All quarrels between the masses are distilled by ultimate power, and only then can the lives of everyone improve. But you see, Thomas Hobbes was actually wrong with this, as this only ever worked with a truly virtuous and benevolent ruler. And yet the oligarchy of 1984 and the oligarchies we see today are just the complete opposite of this. But nonetheless, when there is this benevolent ruler who controls a massive population, the cultural and societal norms of that population always trickle down from the top. And this is where a social habitus forms. Now it may change based on the environment and the people that form the society, but a specific code of conduct always takes shape along the same lines. You see, for example, in a healthy society, the habitus is always focused on ideals like liberty, responsibility, virtue, and discipline. These would be the values, virtues, and moral code of the elite, and then that would trickle down into all areas of society. So this is how the habitus works, and sociologists use the idea of habitus to illustrate the manner in which a society's culture works. You see, there are many unspoken assumptions and standards that underpin society. These are frequently carried out automatically, and they are more akin to acquired skills than deliberate actions. The French thinker Bourdieu, who popularized the word, frequently linked it to sports. For example, the rules of football are set in stone, and you play the game without thinking why the rules are there in the first place. And yet these rules are crucial, otherwise the whole game just wouldn't work without it. And this is also how societies and culture flourishes. And that's why the Renaissance was so remarkable. The new habitus that was developing in Europe in this time gave birth to a whole new wave of creativity, discipline, focus, moral code, and beauty. But then what happens when the values of the elite starts to crack? And the habitus becomes poisoned. What does this then mean for the rest of society? Well, you don't really have to look very far to see how fractured and malformed our habitus has become. I mean, we only need to take a look at who our icons are in society to give us an understanding of what has truly happened here. Due to our hyper-crony capitalist system, the elites and their greed and love of money has spread into every level of society. And I'm not talking about simple capitalism here. I'm talking about the special kind of corporatism and socialism for the rich. You see, for example, we no longer value the European holistic lifestyle, where a person's value is based on many layers of their personality. Instead, today in the West, we only value the superficial to understand someone's value. And this explains the rapid rise of these fake gurus you see online. People like Grant Cardone, London Real, and these vacuous new megachurches. You see, things like this would never even exist without millions of people orientating their self-worth and motivations entirely around money. You see, in contrast to the Renaissance period, they used to care about art and religion, but our new religion is following hedonistic and materialistic pursuits. Now, obviously, there's always need for money, and it's a great way to have freedom in your own life, but it's these sorts of to scammers that completely rely on greed to survive, and greed is the name of the game in modern society. And that's why the greediest of all are then promoted even further, going all the way up to the top of the World Economic Forum. And in a lot of cases, people are just making money simply by talking about money and nothing else. Nothing on actual societal value. And it's not just these sorts of people. Our society now praises these celebrities whose only value lies in their image and wealth. The Kardashians are always mentioned, but there's just so many others, people like Cardi B, the entire cast of Love Island, or any other vacuous, hollowed out shell of a human being celebrity. And because we praise these false idols, everyone then buys into the societal delusion, helping to perpetuate this broken habitus even more. And that's why lots of well-meaning, rational people are swept up to becoming mouthpieces of a failing system. And one of the perfect analogies for our twisted habitus could be seen with the FTX scandal recently. From celebrities to established financial institutions, Sam Bankman-Fried fooled the world by using his own artificial pumped-up currency that had no attachment to anything real to make billions. Everyone believed in it, and that's where the value of these coins came from. By everyone believing in Sam Bankman-Fried's lies, he was able to make unthinkable money. But at the top of the pyramid of FTX, this CEO was a lazy gamer playing League of Legends in the Bahamas, with his whole value being tricking everyone into believing his money was worth something. But then when a gust of wind came, this whole facade came tumbling down in just a matter of days, and our society is heading exactly the same way. You see, as the habitus gets twisted even more, it becomes harder and harder for people to reconcile it with the real world. Then when the illusion breaks and people realize everything is built on a lie, it eventually collapses. And Winston and Julia have also been living a lie separate to the great lie of their society. You see, despite knowing they'll eventually be found out, they carry on seeing each other in the room above the shop. A taste of real life is just too tempting. So Winston enjoys reading subversive literature to Julia, all while enjoying the contraband food that Julia smuggled from the inner party. Things are going great. They finally escape the clutches of Big Brother. They've had a taste of freedom and love. All until one day, when Julia and Winston are relaxing in their room. As they watch a working class woman washing some clothes and singing a song, they marvel at the beauty of life, all the more stunning because they know their time is limited. Winston says to Julia, "We are the dead," and Julia says the same. And then a voice from behind says, "You are the dead." They turn around to see a painting fall off the wall, revealing a telescreen with the visage of Big Brother. The voice directs them to stand in the middle of the room as the thought police break in through the window and the door. Even worse, the antique shop owner walks up the stairs and reveals himself to be an agent of the thought police. Ever since Winston set foot in the shop, he was always under their supervision. The agents take Goldstein's book and smash the piece of coral, one of the last things of beauty left from the old world. And it's one of the last things Winston sees before they take him away to the sinister Ministry of Love. We are then shown Winston in custody, along with his neighbour Parsons. Parsons, not knowing it himself, is apparently an agent of Goldstein, and also a thought criminal. However, he reveals that he was taken in because his daughter reported him for things he said in his sleep. Despite Parsons coming across as completely indoctrinated, he's still going to be tortured and broken down anyway. The two remain in custody for some time, until an announcement wakes them up. Room 101. Parsons seems to already know what this entails, and begs the correctional officers not to take him there. Winston, on the other hand, doesn't seem to have a clue about what's going to happen, but gives a knowing look that it probably isn't going to be good. Despite all of his pleading, Parsons is then taken to room 101, and Winston waits alone in his cell for some time, until he is met with O'Brien. O'Brien takes Winston into an interrogation room, where he is tortured with an electric restraining device. Throughout the time, O'Brien educates Winston on the principles of doublethink. He reaffirms the notion that Oceania has always been at war with East Asia instead of Eurasia, despite the contrary being previously correct. Along with this, O'Brien then asserts that 2 plus 2 can equal 3, 4, or 5, sometimes even all of them at once. And this is the final and most essential ingredient for keeping the party and their stilted habitus alive, rejecting real, authentic reality itself. They need people to trust the party over their own eyes and ears. It's how people are willing to accept that the enemy can change at a moment's notice, and it's how the party will have taken power in the first place. It's in times of great chaos and upheaval that regimes and governments fall and new ones take their place. It's just the cycle of history, and we've seen it happen over and over again. It's how the world order changes, and in our current world right now, the transition is almost here. One of the most famous experts in this field, Ray Dalio, describes the process in a study on historical cycles, beginning with the rise of civilizations. This is when a new state, founded on the dominant ideals of the time, grows in power to take control of their world, like the Roman Empire all the way to America after World War II. Then comes the Golden Age of Prosperity, a long period of time where a civilization enjoys their position at the top. But this is also where the problems start to arise. People make financial bets on the world order continuing forever, unable to see a future unlike the present. As the leading power's economy grows to dominate the others, their currency becomes the international standard. Internal conflicts also arise as the founding ideology becomes out of date with the world, and eventually a bubble forms as people bet more and more on continued growth and prosperity, whilst internal divisions and problems only get worse. Those with power try to consolidate their grip on it, alienating more of the people whilst hoarding all of the wealth. And this then only fuels extremist sentiment and revolution even more. However, sometimes this can be peacefully dealt with, although eventually these problems get so large and the power structure becomes so stagnant that a revolution and changing of the guard becomes inevitable. Then another rising power eventually eclipses the stagnating one. Most of the time there's a war or sets of wars until the dust settles and a new world power comes to the forefront. And time again, this cycle has just repeated itself. In recent history, it was the Dutch who were dominant, followed by the British, then the US, and now China is rising to challenge the US. And that's where we are today, on the cusp of this transitional period. And because of this, our current societal habitus just won't be able to cope with the changing world. As the cracks start to show in the habitus, and the society becomes more and more deranged, we'll then see a massive shift back towards traditionalism, because its birth rates fall, young people fail to find love or happiness, the standard of living starts to drop, and the ideals of the constitution start to get ripped apart, right-wing sentiments will rise again. Meanwhile, the elite to the top are going to keep tightening their grip on power, bringing us closer and closer to a 1984 future. I mean, for starters, we've already talked about the Great Recess, but this is only the tip of the iceberg here. Because right now it's becoming very clear that corporate elites will keep pushing their elitist fake leftism on the masses, all to maintain control of the world order. I mean, we're already seeing this in the West, with huge companies like PayPal's recent announcements on handing out fines for, quote, misinformation, or like MasterCard's carbon fees, where their new credit card cuts people off for exceeding carbon emission levels. All while oil companies make record profits but can't find the money to fix their pipelines and stop massive oil leaks. However, the most disturbing part of this is the new idea of CBDCs, one of the most odious forms of corporate control. And so if corporations and financial institutions manage to push the idea into the mainstream, it will eventually give the banks and governments greater control over people's lives.
It's digital currency, but controlled centrally through the banks, Bank of England. So instead of having a bank account with whatever, HSBC or Bank of America, you'll have a bank account directly with, in the American context, with the Fed. In the UK, directly with the Bank of England. You have a personal bank account, and you're given digital money in that bank account. These are called central banking digital currencies.
Because a centralized bank digital currency means that the government then has full control of the money, and so that everything you spend it on is tracked by the government. And with one push of a button, they will be able to cut off your funds entirely, all for saying the wrong thing. And this will then paralyze you, leaving you at the government's mercy. And this is also a response to the rise of crypto. And yes, crypto may be a paradise for scam artists. The crypto world does also offer currency out of the government's control, which is a massive threat for the growing control in Western society, and is something that can't be accepted by the elite in this transitional period. Now, obviously in 1984, the party and Big Brother are far more advanced in their efforts to control the people. But then again, all the ingredients for their kind of tyranny in our own world are already present. They won't need to torture or indoctrinate people in the way the party does. It's much more subtle than this. It's just a small shift in the habitus, but eventually the end result is the same, complete acceptance of Big Brother's control. And that's why during his torture, Winston begins to disassociate and hallucinates being in a grass field, along with O'Brien. O'Brien states that Winston is one of them, and under significant delusion, Winston says that he loves O'Brien, who suddenly turns into Julia. He still isn't broken down yet, his love for Julia is still there, but just as this happens, the image of Julia is shot, and Winston awakens back in his cell, where he is delusionally talking to himself. Winston then snaps back to reality after being met with O'Brien once more. O'Brien then asks Winston what he thinks of Big Brother, and Winston responds that he hates him. This comes to the distaste of O'Brien, who states that it's not enough to obey Big Brother, but in fact you must love him. So O'Brien escorts Winston to room 101. Room 101 is a torture chamber where the worst things in the world awaits its prisoners, a specialized room that houses the victim's worst phobias. Winston is then strapped to a chair and starts experiencing the horrors of room 101. Now, throughout the movie, we've seen that Winston is deathly afraid of rats. He's dreamt about them and he associates them with his tragic past. And O'Brien knows about this, and he's going to exploit it to finally eradicate Winston's desire to resist. And so in room 101, we see a compartmented cage filled with rats, with a set of two doors that is attached to Winston's face. O'Brien then threatens him, and opens the first door, letting the rats out within inches of Winston's face. And after what could have been months or years of this torture, this is the last straw, and it's here that Winston loses his final bit of humanity, as he pleads with O'Brien to do it to Julia, to finally put the woman that he loves the most through the same unbearable punishment. It's the final betrayal, and what seals Winston's fate as a broken puppet of the party. O'Brien is finally satisfied. Winston has been completely broken. Sometime later, Winston is released, and we then transition to the Chestnut Tree Cafe, where Winston awaits at a chessboard. Julia arrives, but they're both apathetic. They've been changed forever, and after their betrayals, they don't really love each other anymore. They only love Big Brother. And just as Winston makes a comment on thought crime, Julia then excuses herself with a half-hearted,
"We must meet again,"
to which Winston apathetically agrees to. We are then shown Winston on public television, embellishing his supposed crimes, along with admitting to crimes he didn't commit, such as poisoning the water supply and guiding rocket bombs onto Airstrip 1 through coded radio signals. Eventually, Winston charges himself as guilty on all counts, labeling himself a victim of Goldstein's influence. We are then shown him alone at the cafe, fiddling with the chessboard. Using the dust on the table, Winston then writes 2 plus 2 equals 4 on the countertop, and grabs a night piece just as another announcement is made on the television. And that's when we are then shown a final shot of Winston gazing longingly into a picture of Big Brother. He then turns away with tears in his eyes and says, "I love you," as the credits roll. But then this brings up the question, how can we avoid a situation like this, where people are nothing more than just mindless individuals becoming statistics on a government database? How can we avoid being just another loveless, depressed, nihilistic cog in an uncaring machine? Well, I'd love to tell you that the answer is simple. I'd love to say that the solution is just waking up at 4 a.m, having a cold shower and going to the gym. I'd love to say it's hiding away in the middle of the forest. I'd love to say it's money, or a Tony Robbins lecture. I'd love to say it's as easy as buying a $3,000 dropshipping course and escaping the Matrix, driving a Lambo in the palm. But let's be real here, this doesn't actually do anything. By themselves, these are all great things to make you have an easier life. Self-improvement is vital, and it's incredibly lacking in modern society. But it doesn't really change the world that you live in. It only changes yourself. But it doesn't change the system that put you where you are today. It doesn't change your values, the values of your associates, friends, and family. It doesn't change the why behind all of the self-improvement stuff. Why should you improve your life? Why should you seek freedom? Why should you even care about Big Brother? If life is just so cruel, hopeless, depressing, and empty, then why bother chasing rewards from that system, when the system itself is so demented? Well, trust me when I say that the solution to all of this is just so much deeper than you've ever been told. And to understand why, we need to go back 3,000 years in time, to one of the earliest philosophical texts in human history, a text that has transcended time, culture, and religion, a text known as the Book of Job. Now, for those who don't know, the book is a thought-provoking and complex piece on God, giving direction on the meaning of life in face of overwhelming nihilism. You see, the story centers around a wealthy and righteous man named Job, who is living a comfortable and prosperous life. However, in short, Satan challenges God's assertion that Job is righteous, suggesting that he is only faithful because of his good fortune. So God agrees to allow Satan to test Job's faith by taking away his possessions, his family, and his health. This causes immense suffering for Job, but Job refuses to curse God or renounce his faith. However, he does struggle to understand why he is suffering, and he moans about the injustice of his situation, as almost all of us would. He questions why God would allow such terrible things to happen to a righteous person like himself. He's forced to go through various trials and tribulations. Job is tested to his core, which forces him to grow through a journey of his self. Job's friends, who come to comfort him, offer him traditional explanations for his suffering. They suggest that he must have sinned and that his suffering is just a punishment from God, that he's a bad guy who deserves it. But Job rejects all these simple explanations, insisting that he has not sinned, and demands an audience with God to plead his case. Eventually, this whole book culminates in God's response to Job's demands. God speaks to Job from a whirlwind, and challenges him to consider the vastness and complexity of the natural world, asking Job if he can even comprehend the mysteries of the universe, and Job humbly acknowledges his own limitations, as God tells him that he made all these terrible elements of society and nature. He made the universe, and all of the badness in the universe is God's creation. And so God's response to Job is, "How dare you question any of these things?" As these challenges put on Job are just tests of his ethical ability. They're essential for Job to evolve and grow as a person, just like it is for us. You see, I'm not even religious here, but the terrible parts of nature and society that God has supposedly created are only noticed with consciousness. Like Job being aware of losing his family fortunes and the future he could have had, and then the resulting suffering from it that has come from his consciousness. And then you see, when we are unconscious like animals, we are always in the present, unaware of true reality. But as consciousness emerged in humans, we became more and more aware of the dark realities around us. Realities like the horrors of death and human suffering. And it's with these dark, soul-crushing realities that we have an impulse to return to unconsciousness. And we do this through instant gratification and empty pursuits, like never maturing, choosing to be ignorant, drugs, alcohol, and terminally living online. These are just some of the things that we use to cope with the real world and the pain that comes with it. But Carl Jung suggested that what the Book of Job tells us about our own life is that to escape the horrors of man, Job and you watching this needed to become more conscious, as consciousness was actually the true solution to all of this. As by being more and more conscious of reality, it allows you to elevate above it, because all the burdens and pain of life are just a necessary process to make you a whole person. To be a good person, to build a great civilization, you have to face these trials and tribulations. You need to be more aware, more thoughtful of all the evil in the world to be a better person. To be strong in the face of evil, you need to be strong in the face of all the devastating facts of life, of the derangement of the elites, and the degeneracy of the society around you. You should never avoid all the terrible thoughts and events confronting you. You should never ignore all the pain, suffering, and nihilism being thrown at you by our corrupt society. As Jung famously said, that which you most need will be found where you least want to look. And that's why, instead of following your bliss like modern culture tells you to, you need to instead follow your blisters for a true awakening. And so, with all of this in mind, Job then finally understood that God was there to build order from chaos, because he is the embodiment of evolution and growth. While on the surface you may just view this as some basic religious story, the actual meaning to the story is deeply profound, and provides a perfect solution to the problem of 1984 and our own modern world. You see the whole point of this, the whole point of why this text has transcended thousands of years of history. The reason it's been studied by millions of scholars is for a reason. The writers use the story as an allegory of the spirit of individual growth, and thus the whole of human civilization. God in this instance is the analogy for the spirit of meaning, growth, and human potential, the spirit that generates human culture. And that's why throughout all religions of mankind, God has been above the culture, as he is the spirit of it. And there's a reason this is so important to understand. I'm not trying to convert you to any religion here. This is just a very necessary foundation to understand the solution to all of this subversion and control of Big Brother. You see, this whole story is one of faith in the face of adversity, of trusting in your mind and intuition. And that's why God, the spirit of growth and potential, is revealed to us through the actions we undertake in our life. This is why prayer is a key element of all religions. And I'm not talking about the kind of prayer where you ask for something and God automatically gives you it. Prayers aren't a vending machine. The idea of true prayer is saying the problem and then changing who you are so that God treats you differently and the problem fades away. You're not supposed to be the same person before you pray. The prayer is meant to instead act on your mind by trusting your intuition and mind to be the better person. And then through your actions, growth and rewards come to you, which is ultimately the solution to Big Brother in our modern world. By trusting your intuition and guts and by being an individual. You know, before in the US, the dignity of the individual was paramount. But now, if you notice, this concept is being betrayed. As Oscar Wilde said, most people now are just other people. Their lives are mimicry, their passions are quotation. Which is why you must trust yourself. You must reject Big Brother. All the supposed authority figures you're meant to believe are liars. They're the worst among us, and they will lead you to your own destruction. The world you live is not some democratic liberal utopia where everyone has a piece of the action, where culture and policy is determined by all of us. That is total BS. The priestly caste at the top, Big Brother, wants to control you. They're not there to save your soul or fire the spirit up inside of your mind, which is why the more you follow their narratives and their lifestyle, the more you start to poison yourself. You see, the reason you're lazy, the reason you have all these bad habits, the reason you never achieve the life that you want or chase the goals and passion that you believe in is because you've been repressed. The meaning and soul of your life has been stripped away from you, making you a cog in an uncaring machine. Your life is someone else's, where your best years, your character, creativity, and hopes are being stolen from you. And that's why you must insist on your dignity. You need to free your mind. You must reject all the noise around you and embrace the chaos, the pain, and the sorrow to grow. And if you don't, you become another pawn of Big Brother. You're the person who didn't even fight back. You never did anything to go against the system poisoning your life. Too passive to actually care what's happening to you and the people around you. Is this the life you want to live? Well, for many of us, we're starting to see the rejection of all of this. Because as we enter the age of Western civilization collapsing, with the government trying to control us more and people becoming more atomized, depressed, and lonelier than ever, we're now starting to see antibodies being produced to overcome the societal disease. We're seeing more and more people rejecting the values of our twisted habitus. With all the bullshit fed to you by Big Brother, the pendulum towards individualism is swinging back. And that's why when I see this rise in self-improvement, this rise in individualism, when I see all these big political changes happening in the world, it just shows to me that the new world order is on the horizon. The spirit of growth is nearing. A spirit of dignity, empowerment, and hope for young men. The hope that our culture has killed and used against us. And so, after millions of successfully lived lives throughout all periods of history, the challenge to grow now passes on to you. You will determine the future of the next generation. Your mind determines the direction of everything. So don't just give it up for some sick cultural narratives. Giving your genius to the worst among us, you should act without regret. Follow the path in front of you and take back control of your mind. I want to tell you about something I've been working on this past month. You see, I've built something that I legitimately think will change your life. Because you see, for most of your life, you've always been fed a constant stream of lies. Lies that have poisoned your value systems, purpose, and passion in life, whilst also poisoning the community around you. And it's why you feel so lazy, so meaningless, so lonely. And so it's time that we've come up with real solutions. Not just modern day BS solutions. I'm talking about a new form of community. A way for us to take back control of our lives. Where I will go deep into the real solutions, answers, and value systems of thousands of philosophers condensed into an easy to understand package. All to help you improve your life. All at no cost to you, I will send you a weekly essay on the solutions to the problems we discuss on this channel. So just click on the link in the description and add your email and name down below.